Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on marriage when we come back. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state. And like any other state-licensed enterprise, marriage is regulated by the Welfare Department, the Department of Family Services, and the Family Court. Now, the best part about all of this is that you don't have any input into, you don't have any say-so over, the marriage, divorce, dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, protective custody, or restraining orders. But you get to pay for all of that, and if you fail to pay for it, you go to jail. Now, marriage is the most important, and it's the most expensive contract that you can engage in. It's more binding, and it's more costly than your military enlistment or your 30-year home mortgage. And I'll bet you know a whole lot less about that marriage contract than you do about your military obligation or your house payments. Two-thirds of marriages in the United States end in divorce. But whether you're a husband or a wife, when this divorce occurs, you have rights, privileges, and immunities to advance, to protect, or to defend against a breach of this marriage contract. And that's why you ought to know and understand the terms and conditions of that marriage contract before you marry. And you probably would be better off writing it yourself instead of letting the state write it for you. So whether you're married or not, why don't you write for my free general law CD package and let me share some vital statistics and information with you about the law and that marriage contract. The number to call, 417-273-4967. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's an entertaining, educational, and informative program. Best of all, it's free. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's easy to remember, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. Now, let's talk about a common law marriage. We talked about the civil law marriage, the one with the contract, that is the marriage license. Remember, a license is permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass, and it's a contract, a three-party limited general contract, between three parties, the state, the boy, and the girl. But a common law marriage isn't a contract with the state. It's not a contract with the state, but it's treated for the purposes of divorce, child custody, or alimony, child support, for practical purposes in many of the states that recognize common law marriage. It's treated as a civil law marriage, with some exceptions. Now, a common law marriage is a marriage that is affected by agreement of the parties without the benefit of the formality of a church ceremony, an officiating officer, and without a license. There must be a mutual understanding to presently enter into marriage relationship, permanent and exclusive of all others, after which there is a public recognition of the circumstances to establish a common law marriage. A common law marriage is an agreement between a man and a woman who are legally competent to contract a marriage and who are willing to do so, whereby they do in each other's presence consent to live as husband and wife. And where the plaintiff moved into the defendant's home and lived with the defendant when the plaintiff knew that the defendant was married to another woman who was living and could not form a marriage relationship with the plaintiff. The defendant refused to consent to marry the plaintiff. A common law marriage did not result, although the plaintiff and the defendant lived together for several years. And to constitute a common law marriage, there must be an agreement between the parties to take each other as husband and wife, to enter into a relation which was to continue until death, with resulting obligations of husband and wife, and while the consent is of itself sufficient, there is no substitute to or equivalent such as sexual relations, living together, and using the same name. Oftentimes people believe that if they live together, that's a common law marriage, or if they have sexual relations, it creates a common law marriage, or using somebody else's name constitutes a common law marriage, and that's not true. Marriage is formed by an agreement with penetration in all three forms, agreement. And the agreement of the female is necessary, and that occurs at the wedding ceremony when she is asked plainly, will you go out with this man and be his wife? If she says, no, I won't, you don't have marriage. You might have kidnapping. You might have man or woman stealing. You might have something else, but you don't have a marriage. Now, over in Oklahoma, they recognize common law marriage. They treat it just like it's a civil law marriage for the purposes of divorce. Texas recognizes common law marriage. Tennessee does not. So while many states don't recognize common law marriage, if you were married in a common law state and then moved to a community property state, the community property state would be bound to recognize your common law marriage under interstate compact. It's done in the Constitution. It's a constitutional provision which requires each state to give full faith and credit to the laws of the other states. But you can't have a common law marriage established in Tennessee because Tennessee won't recognize common law marriage. Now this brings us up to the next part of the program, which defines what these three marriages are by definition. Now, a civil law marriage is a three-party limited general partnership involving the boy, the girl, the state. It's an agreement or contract by, for, among, or between these three parties as evidenced by the marriage license. A common law marriage is a two-party contract between the boy and the girl. There may be a written instrument, but a written instrument is not necessary. The marriage is done by agreement and penetration. Many states recognize common law marriage, property and children, by the birth certificate of the parties, and it's very little different from the civil law marriage. Now, the third is called a patriarchal marriage, and that's a contract between the boy and the girl's father. The girl is not a party to the contract. The father gives the girl to the boy in a public ceremony and transfers his liability to the boy. In Hebrew law, a female must be taken care of from the cradle to the grave. The contract terminates upon consummation. When the penetration occurs, the contract between the boy and the girl's father terminates. It's now been fulfilled. The property has now transacted. It's changed hands. The female is the object. It's like buying a cow at the auction. The cow belongs to party A, who brings it to the auction, party B, to sell to somebody, party C. When party C agrees to buy the cow, that's the beginning of the contract, not the completion. Party B, the sale barn, never owns the cow and is never a party to the cow. The cow is never a party to the contract. Party A and party C are the parties to the contract, and when party C pays party B, The contract is completed. He loads up the cow and takes it with him. Same thing happens in a marriage ceremony. The father of the bride delivers the bride and gives her away in a public ceremony in which the boy accepts and then takes the property and leaves with her at the end of the marriage ceremony. Now, I thought that it might be instructive to put in the qualifications for a wife. I showed you what Proverbs 31, what God thought a good wife ought to entail. So, following scriptural law, if you were a white Anglo-Saxon, what you would be looking for if you were a male in a wife. Now, if you're a female, you ought to write up a list. What are you looking for in a husband? What should this guy look like? What should he be like? So, if you were an Anglo-Saxon male looking for a wife, you'd be looking for someone fair-complexioned, tall, Israelite or German, from 10-plus generations of good breeding with no mixed blood, politically conservative, non-denominational Christian, trained in or willing to be trained in the law of Moses, a practitioner of the law of God, be versed in the duties of a woman pursuant to Proverbs 31, trained in cooking, cleaning, gardening, medicine, preserving, planning, and child-rearing, or be willing to be taught, intellectually oriented, has a head for business, athletic or active, intelligent, articulate, literate, and well-read, should be well-traveled, have a good sense of humor, 25 to 35 years old, she could be divorced with children, with no mixed blood children, in good health, strong, not frail, without any operations for the removal of vital organs such as gallbladder, tonsils, adenoids, female organs, or appendix, free from VD, TB, cancer, diabetes, AIDS, or other degenerative diseases, physical deformities, or obesity, free from mental defects, has no family history of genetic diseases, has a dowry of $25,000 to $50,000 in cash or property, has productive work habits, prepared to leave parents, free from Social Security, free from birth certificate, free from state contracts, free from 14th Amendment citizenship, and free from all guardian ward relationships, and competent to enter a marriage contract. Now, if you're a female, or if you're a black, or an oriental, or a Hawaiian, or a Polynesian, or even from some other race, or an Arab, or an Arabian, you would be looking for those characteristics and traits in a person of your race. That would comply with the Mosaic Law. Now, of course, most people aren't very concerned about the Mosaic Law, and they don't really care one way or the other. And that's why you have the violations of these marriage laws. That's why you have the Roman civil law. That's why we have marriage licenses. These are people that aren't concerned and are not particularly interested in practicing the law of Moses, the Mosaic Law. Now, there's the basic story on marriage. We wouldn't be quite complete with marriage if we didn't cover another vital aspect of marriage, which is known as polygamy. Now, polygamy is a social status created by the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham was a polygamist. Isaac was not a polygamist. Jacob was a polygamist, as was Jacob's firstborn son Esau, and Jacob's secondborn son Jacob. Jacob was a polygamist and had four wives, 12 boys and one girl. David was a polygamist. Saul was a polygamist. Solomon was a polygamist. And Jesus said that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. He went on to say in Matthew 5:17 that we ought not to think that he came to abolish or destroy the law. He further went on to say that he was the same yesterday, today, and forever, and said, I change not. That's the basis or the doctrine of stare decisis. Now, in the United States, the seminal case in polygamy is called Reynolds versus United States. Americans, by and large, I would say about 99.9% of all Americans are opposed to plural marriage. They are opposed to polygamy. There is only one group that I know of in the United States that ever practiced polygamy, at least on a large scale, and that was the Mormon Church prior to 1880. Now, the Mormons practiced polygamy as a part and parcel of their religious beliefs and tenets. And a fellow by the name of Reynolds had two wives. In 1876, Congress enacted a law. Congress said it's now, from this point forward, illegal to have two wives. Two wives at the same time. Now, polygamy is practiced in two forms, and it's spelled two ways. It's spelled P-O-L-Y-G-A-M-Y, or it's spelled P-O-L-Y-G-E-M-Y. Polygamy, when it's practiced one wife at a time, that is, plural marriages, plural wives, but one at a time, is spelled P-O-L-Y-G-E-M-Y, and it's very common to practice polygamy in that form in the United States and indeed worldwide. Elizabeth Taylor is a polygamist. She's had seven or eight husbands, one at a time. When a female practices polygamy, we call it polyandry. Polyandry violates the Mosaic Law because a woman can only have one husband at a time. She can have many, many husbands, as we see in Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. Jesus also answered that question for the Pharisees. They came to him one day and said, "This woman over here has had seven husbands. In the resurrection, whose wife shall she be?" So they recognized polygamy, and they recognized P-O-L-Y-G-E-M-Y as a very common form of polygamy. Now, P-O-L-Y-G-A-M-Y, polygamy, practiced as the Mormons practiced it, having more than one wife at the same time, is what the Mormons were practicing and what was legal and lawful in the United States prior to 1876. But when Congress acted, outlawing the practice, which was obviously aimed at this one religious sect or organization called the Mormons, the Supreme Court upheld the law in the case called Reynolds versus United States. Now, up to today, all legal scholars are agreed that the Reynolds case was decided by the Supreme Court, and it was obviously a prejudice or a bias, and it was bad law, and it was poorly decided because of the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause. Well, I beg to disagree, because I believe that the Supreme Court in Reynolds versus U.S. in 1878 made the right decision. They made the right decision because Reynolds never denied or pled out of the fiction of law that he had a marriage license. I've never seen anyone look at the fiction of law created in the Reynolds Doctrine. I hear their arguments and I read them. And had Reynolds argued with a demur that he did in fact have two wives, but that the First Amendment granted him that right because of religious free exercise and that Congress was prohibited from impairing his religious duties and obligations and that he did not have a marriage license, I think the court would have ruled differently. Now, the court may well indeed have been polarized, or they may have been biased or prejudiced against him. I don't know that, but I don't think that the decision in Reynolds was incorrect. So I'm in a minority view in that regard, although And today, the same people who believe that the court erred in the Reynolds decision would probably, by and large, be opposed to polygamy. I'm not opposed to polygamy because polygamy is scriptural. Now, it may well be that it's bad religion and bad politics and politically incorrect, but it's not bad law because God created it. And to my knowledge, God hasn't created any bad law, although we think that he has, and we've been very busy correcting all of his mistakes, and we have corrected his polygamy mistake, but I'm not really sure that that's the case. So let's look into polygamy and see, did God really make a mistake when he created polygamy, plural wives, at the same time? Going back to Reynolds, Reynolds was arrested and jailed and charged with polygamy, and the chief witness against him was a fellow polygamist. The chief witness against Reynolds testified that he too was a polygamist. Well, he didn't admit to being a polygamist, but he admitted that he was having sexual relations with more than one woman, and that when he was asked by the U.S. attorney if that was polygamy, he said, no, that was fornication. Well, that may well be the case in that witness's view, but fornication is legally distinguishable from polygamy, and legally distinguishable from marriage, and legally distinguishable from adultery. Well, at least according to the laws of God. Now, we like to corrupt and pollute our language so that we can do things that are patently illegal and unlawful under the Mosaic law. That's why we get a marriage license. It's so that we can violate the law that's set down by Moses, set down by God. So, anytime you have a license, it's prima facie evidence of a crime. So, when Congress came along in 1876 and said, listen, you got to have a marriage license, Illinois was the first state to pick up on that and start issuing marriage licenses. That was the beginning of the marriage license program here in the United States. It started in Illinois with the Congressional Prohibition Against Polygamy in 1876. Marriage licenses were not common even in 1900, but by 1920, nearly everybody had made the conversion from common law or patriarchal marriage to civil law marriage with a license by 1920 in that 40-year period. We also made the conversion from patriarchal family, where we kept our own records and books in our family Bible. By 1900, birth certificates were not common, but by 1920 they were, and today they're universal. Now, there are some people that have avoided marriage licenses and birth certificates, but they're very rare. Very rare. I don't know how many there are, but I would doubt seriously that 1% of the American public does not have a birth certificate or a marriage license. Well, Reynolds took the stand and he testified that he did in fact have two wives and that he was relying upon the First Amendment's free exercise clause, and he said the court didn't have jurisdiction not to be meddling in his religious affairs. The court disagreed, found him guilty. The case went up to the Supreme Court and it came down 7-0 and upheld his conviction. Thereafter, the Mormon Church capitulated and decided that polygamy probably wasn't a good plan, and they changed their religious doctrine to match the religious doctrine imposed by the Congress. I'm not sure that that was a good plan, and I don't think God approves of people changing religious doctrine, particularly when the religious doctrine is correct and biblical. And polygamy is correct and biblical, so why the Mormons gave it up, I don't know, but they obviously didn't want to fight for their religious beliefs. They obviously did not want to, they didn't want to go into the fiery furnace or the lion's den in defense of the laws of God. So as I mentioned, Reynolds' mistake was a fiction of law occurred. For instance, let's suppose that an MP comes into my office and he says, I'm looking for George Gordon. So I raise my hand and I say, well, I'm George Gordon, and he announces that he has a warrant for my arrest, and he promptly arrests me, loads me in his Jeep, and he charges me in his arrest warrant with being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. In the classroom, I commonly ask students, isn't that ridiculous? Isn't that preposterous? Isn't that patently false? Most people will say, well, of course it is. The truth of the matter is, the factual allegations in the complaint are true, accurate, and correct. Number one, he says, I'm looking for George Gordon. I confessed to being George Gordon, or at least one of them. There may be more than one in the country. I may not be the George Gordon that he's looking for, but I'm a George Gordon, and he's looking for George Gordon, and he's found one, and I confessed to it. I stipulated to that fact. He says, you're under arrest. Then he charges me with being absent. He continues, he says, you're not only absent, you're absent from Fort Lewis, Washington. And he goes on a step further and says, without leave. And so the legal question we need to ask is George Gordon absent from Fort Lewis? Well, as I'm sitting in my office in Isabella, Missouri, that's a factual complaint. I am George Gordon, and I am absent. He goes on to say, you're not only absent, but you're absent from Fort Lewis, Washington. And I could say that's true because not only am I absent, I'm absent from Fort Lewis, Washington, here in Isabella, Missouri. And then finally, he might say, well, you're absent without leave. Now, that's a question of fact, but I'll stipulate to that fact. I don't have anybody's permission from Fort Lewis, Washington, to be here today. So if the MP came into my office and said, I'm looking for George Gordon, he's charged with being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, then he would be factually correct. Now, in any allegation that's being brought in court in Anglo-Saxon administration, we require two elements. We have to have a factual element and a legal element. Now, factually, the complaint is correct. Legally, the complaint is incorrect. Now, when we're charged factually and we want to make a factual defense, we plead to the charges, such as guilty or not guilty or nolo contendere. We might actually practice a plea of non assumpsit by way of confession and avoidance, or we might stand mute, or we could make a plea in bar or a plea in double jeopardy. So there are seven pleas that we could enter here. But if we wanted to allege, or if we wanted to bring forth a legal defense, we would then demur. And a demur says, yes, the factual allegations are true, accurate, and correct, but the legal basis upon which you reside or rest your case is incorrect. And that is, I'm not a soldier in the army. And Reynolds never did that. At least if he did that, the Supreme Court of the United States didn't put it into the record. Because when we read Reynolds, there isn't any evidence that he walked into the trial court and said, wait a minute, I don't have a marriage license. Now, when Congress enacts laws, they do not enact laws that violate our First Amendment rights to free exercise, but you know, you don't have a right to use religious free exercise to violate the laws of the United States. Now, the United States government is not opposed to fornication. And if you go out and have sexual relations with 15 women, the United States government doesn't care, doesn't get excited about that. But if you go out and have sexual relations with two women that you're calling your two wives, oh, they get really upset about that. Now, for you polygamists out there, if you would practice your polygamy without involving the government under contract with a license, nobody would bother you because it would be construed as fornication, which is precisely what the government's chief witness against Reynolds declared in his case of polygamy. He says, I'm not a polygamist, I'm a fornicator. No law against that. Well, God has a law against it, but the United States doesn't. Now, God doesn't have any law against having 2, 3, 9, or 11 wives, but the United States does. So it's important, if you're going to practice polygamy in the biblical methodology, then you can't have a state marriage license. And it makes all the sense in the world, because Jesus himself said, you can't serve two masters. In Matthew 6:24, he said, you know, you can't serve two masters, boys and girls. You'll hold to the one, hate the other, vice versa. So if you want to practice polygamy, do it without a marriage license. If you want to practice marriage with a marriage license, then make sure that you practice polygamy one wife at a time. Now, that's the bottom line to that story. Now, I got to give you a reminder right here, and we'll be back with more on this thing of polygamy and marriage when we return. Let me remind you that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about marriage. Now, the laws on marriage are few in the Bible. There isn't a great big long list of do's and don'ts. You've got more laws concerning marriage in your state statutes than God has in the Scripture. He just had a few, 4 or 5 things. I covered the duty of the husband's brother and marrying outside of your race. Those are the two big restrictions. Now, there are guides to this process in marriage called polygamy. Polygamy, that is, having more than one wife at the same time. Now, as an illustration to show you that it's scriptural, there are 24 cases of polygamy in the Scripture. 24 cases. Not very many. Out of millions of people who have lived, billions for that matter, and of the dozens, probably hundreds of characters in the Bible that are mentioned in the Scripture, only 24 of them practiced polygamy. Well, that we know of. There could have been 100 or 200 or 5,000, but they're not mentioned. Now, there's a phenomenon among human beings that I'm not sure occurs among cattle or among other species, and that is, among humans, there are more females born than males. In fact, it's 1.5% more. There's 51.5% of the people being born female, 48.5% are male. And then to add to that, 5% of males do not reach adulthood. They get killed in the process. So there's an imbalance in the world. And here in the United States, you know, Andy Rooney was on the other night, and I wished I'd have remembered this number. He said there's 151 million females and 140-some million males. You know, there's about 10 or 12 million more females in the United States than there are males. Now, what that means is that if every male went out and married, which every male isn't going to do, but if every male did that, there would still be 10 or 12 million females that would never have a husband. I suspect that God designed the process that way back, you know, at creation. Not entirely clear why, but it's entirely clear that polygamy solves the problem for those unmarried females. Some of those, not a very large percentage, but, you know, about, you know, 1.5 to 3% of marriages should be polygamous. Now, polygamy isn't for the purposes of sex. I think that most people think, oh, that dirty pervert's got two wives. It has nothing to do with sex, per se. Sex is the frosting on the cake of marriage. It's kind of a side event. It's an important part of marriage. I don't deny that. But it's not the reason for getting married. Today, of course, it is. People today who are getting married or planning marriage only have one thing on their mind. It's sexual relations. But in the scripture, while sexual relations are an important part of marriage, it's not the reason for marriage. Business is. And polygamy is business. Polygamy is business. Some years ago, I was approached by a committee down in Salt Lake City, and they were defending a polygamist. He was a policeman. He's written in the literature. I forgot his name now, but he's one of the famous polygamy cases. Reynolds is number one. This guy is another famous one back in 1984. In any event, he's a Mormon policeman in Murray, Utah, and he has three wives. And when the event became public, he was fired from the police force, and then he was prosecuted criminally, and then he filed a civil action against the police and said, look, I'm going to correct this Reynolds problem because I've got rights, and the First Amendment is here to protect my rights to free exercise. Now, I imagine that he wanted to correct the Reynolds error. And at the time, I didn't know too much about polygamy, and I was approached, and they asked me, well, can you help us with this defense? And I said, I don't know. But I'll tell you what. Why don't you come up here to Boise, to Barrister's Inn? That was the name of our law school back in the 1980s. And let me research this out, and let me ask around and see if we can learn a little something about this polygamy thing. Maybe this is something that we want to test. You know, like Rosa Parks testing blacks riding the front of the bus. So they agreed, and they came up about a week later, and by this time I'd had an opportunity to go down to the law library and read Reynolds and read some of the polygamy cases, and I read the Bible and Blackstone's commentaries and so on. When I got through, I was pretty well ready for the fellow when he came up, and they came, there was two of them came up, as a matter of fact, from the committee. And they're very excited. And they said, oh, Mr. Gordon, we're just really excited to be here, and we're looking forward to working with you, and we think this is a very valuable constitutional issue and a very valuable constitutional case. And I said, well, let's see. I said, let me ask you a couple questions first. By any chance, Does this policeman have a marriage license with one or more of these three females? And they said, oh, yes, he has a marriage license with all three. I believe it was all three. And I said, okay, second question is any two or more of these three women, are they sisters? And they said, yes, two of them are sisters. And I said, okay. Now we can proceed. And they said, well, no, what have you come up with, and what do you think? And I said, okay, you can't get there from here. And that's because in the scripture, it's against the law to marry sisters. There's a scriptural prohibition against marrying two women who are sisters. Now remember, God doesn't have very many prohibitions, but that's one of them. And I said, the second thing is, the fact that he has a marriage license with one or more of these three women is a killer, because he's in violation of the federal statute, and he's in violation of Reynolds. Because the fiction of law in Reynolds is that Reynolds had a marriage license. Although the case never talks about a marriage license, it never comes up. But Congress doesn't have any jurisdiction or capacity to regulate your religious beliefs or practices. None. Zero. Zilch. Congress does not seek to regulate you having sexual relations with two women. They just seek to regulate you having a marriage license with two wives. So if you want a patriarchal marriage, not a civil law marriage, not a common law marriage, if you want a patriarchal marriage pursuant to the scriptures with two women, or six or 19, so long as they're all consenting adults, of course, I don't think that you're going to go very far marrying 14-year-old girls, but I think that if they're 21 years old, I think you can do this. And you can have a marriage ceremony. Before we got off onto this thing of marriage licenses, you know, we've always had marriage ceremonies. Now, you probably will play hell trying to find a preacher, a Christian preacher somewhere, who's going to marry you, knowing that you're a polygamist. But then, you don't need a preacher. Remember, you can do this yourself. You don't need any ceremony. You just need agreement and penetration. But in a patriarchal marriage, now remember, you need the permission of the father, and you need a bride price. You need a dowry for this female. I mean, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it right. All right, so there's two polygamy cases. Now, let me point out that King David not only was a polygamist, but he had six wives. You know, he wasn't anywhere near his boy Solomon, who had 1,000, but he did have six. And there was a particular woman that he really liked. Her name was Bathsheba. And being the king, you know, he thought, well, no reason why I shouldn't have her. Come to find out, she's married, and married to an army officer. And so David, being commander-in-chief of the army, had this army officer sent out to battle and killed in a battle. Sent him out in the front ranks and said, well, withdraw from him and then let him get killed out there by himself. And then that'll free his wife up for me to marry. So God got a little bit bummed out about that. And in the conversation, he sent a prophet by the name of Nathan, I believe it was. Nathan or Nathaniel, something like that. Over to talk to David about this adultery problem he was having with Bathsheba. And Nathan came over and he said, told him a little parable. He said, there's a guy out here in your kingdom, and he's got just one ewe. Just one ewe. But it's a prized ewe. I mean, this is a beautiful ewe now being a female sheep. Now, and he said, it's the only one he's got. But he's got a neighbor over here that's got thousands. And the neighbor over here came over and stole his only ewe. And he took this guy out and killed him on top of that so he could steal his only ewe. And Nathan asked David, he said, what do you think ought to be done with somebody that does that in your kingdom? And David said he should be killed, he should be slain. Bring him before me and we'll slay him. And Nathan said, you're him. You're the guy. You're the guy. You stole this guy's wife and had him killed. That was quite a story. Now, in the story, God instructed Nathan to tell David that he gave him Saul's wives, plural. God never was opposed to David having 2, 3, 5, 9, 15 wives, although there is a prohibition against a king multiplying wives to himself. There's a prohibition. It's not a prohibition to me or to you, but to a king it is. George Bush ought not to have, 15, 20, or 30 wives. If he had two or three or five, that'd probably be all right. God didn't have any complaints about David having six, but he was a little bummed out about Solomon having 1,000. Now that he wasn't too happy with. So, you need to kind of keep this in moderation. So keeping in mind then, from a scriptural perspective, Jacob had four wives. Abraham had two. And David had six. Solomon had 1,000. Esau had two. And there's 24 people in the Bible, 24 cases of that recorded. Not a negative comment any time from God concerning people that had 2, 5, or 9 wives, although it's pretty obvious that some of these people violated some laws in the process of practicing polygamy. Now let me tell you about another polygamy here. It happened out in Salt Lake City. A fellow gave me a call, and he said he was having problems with his trucking company out in Page, Arizona, and he wondered if he could come up to Barrister's Inn, talk to me about that, and if we could work out a solution. I said, well, I don't know, but why don't you come on up and let's talk about it. So he did. He came up to the office, and as is my habit, in order to have privacy, I suggested that we go down to Elmer's Pancake House down on Capitol, just down the street a little ways, and we'd have dinner. It was in the evening. And we'd have time to talk, and we wouldn't be interrupted by the phone or by other people, and so we did. And when we got down there when we met at the restaurant, rather, we didn't go together, we met there. He was with a lady. Now, this fellow was probably in his 60s, and this lady was probably 60 years old, certainly in her 50s, but, I would presume she might have been 60. I looked at him. He had a great big diamond ring on. I mean, this rock this guy was wearing was probably 3, maybe 4 carats. That was one big diamond ring. This guy had about an $80,000 ring on 1983. And I could tell he was dressed well. And she was dressed very well. And I could see that these were people of substance. These weren't the average poor white trash that you run into from time to time, living in a trailer house, down here on the wrong side of the tracks. These were pretty substantive people. So we sat down. He introduced his wife. He said, "This is my first wife, Agnes." I thought that was a little peculiar. My first wife, Agnes. I was married, and I never introduced my wife as being my first wife because I've heard that joke. There's a joke out there about your first wife, Agnes. And so I sat down, and as we began to talk, he was talking about his third wife, Betty, and pretty soon his fourth wife, Alice, and then his first wife, Agnes, and then his fifth wife, June, and so on. And, as the conversation wore on, it dawned on me that this guy was a Mormon polygamist who had 5 wives and 15 sons. Now, in our transaction, I never did discover how many daughters he had, but the law of averages, being what they are, if you've got 15 sons, you probably have somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 daughters. They generally come out about 50-50. As a matter of fact, as I pointed out earlier, females come out a little more often than males. So if he's got 15 male children, he should have a couple, 3 or more females. Although he didn't mention that. And we were talking about his trucking company in Page, Arizona. As it turned out, he owned the Murray, Utah Sand and Gravel Company. Now, for you people that live out there in the Salt Lake Valley, when you look over there driving down the freeway, and you look off there to the right, what you're looking off to down there, down past the prison, the Murray, Utah Sand and Gravel Company, that's not Mickey Mouse. That's a pretty good size operation. And so he told me about his dairy farm in Spanish Fork and his holdings and price and his contracting company, and his son number five ran the contracting company, and so on. And so it dawned on me that this guy was a businessman, the patriarch of the family, and that this patriarch was operating 15 businesses, and each one of his sons operated one of those businesses. And of course, then the firstborn son would then, upon his death, take over the helm of the enterprise and become the patriarch of the family, taking the double portion. Let me ask you this, thinking about this. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, that the Sand and Gravel Company is, they also make concrete. And let's suppose that the contracting company has a job and they're going to pour concrete in this job. They're going to construct a building and they're going to order some ready mix. What ready mix company do you think that the family contracting business is going to order the concrete from? If you said the Murray, Utah Sand and Gravel or Ready Mix Company, I think you got that about right. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion, that the Murray, Utah Sand and Gravel Ready Mix Company, they need to order a truckload or two or five truckloads of cement from, say, Lovelock, Nevada. And what trucking company do you think they're going to use? Garrett, Yellow Freight, or do you think they're going to use the family trucking company? Well, if you said the family trucking company, you got that right. All right. So what you're looking at here is a vertically integrated family business. Now, Henry Ford did something like that. Henry Ford created this industrial giant called the Ford Motor Company. First of all, he invented this Ford car, remember, back about 1908. And then by 1913, he had a pretty good size operation going. And one day, Henry Ford took a look at the amount of steel he was buying to build all of these automobiles. And he went out and he bought a steel mill in Gary, Indiana. Then, instead of paying $30 a ton for steel, he was manufacturing his own steel for $15 a ton. So while General Motors was paying $30 a ton to United States Steel to buy their steel, Henry Ford was paying $15 a ton to manufacture his own steel in his own steel mill. This gave Henry Ford a competitive advantage, did it not? This is called vertical integration. Now, Henry Ford realized that he was hauling in a lot of iron ore from the Great Lakes, and that he was paying a pretty penny for this iron ore that he was buying up in the upper peninsula of Michigan to melt down or smelt down or to manufacture steel. So he went up to the Mesabi Range and bought an iron mine. Then he was using his own iron ore in his own steel mill, and he figured that, well, gee, I'm spending a lot of money hauling my iron ore from the upper peninsula down here to Gary, Indiana, to my steel mill. So he bought some ore carriers, and the Ford Motor Company to this day operates 12 ore carriers on the Great Lakes, hauling iron ore down to the Ford steel mills. Then Henry Ford looked up and he said, gee, I buy a lot of glass, and he bought a plate glass company. And then he said, gee, I buy a lot of tires. And so he established rubber plantations in South America to make tires. And this is what we call vertical integration. That is, the enterprise, the company, actually manufactures much of what goes into its product. And today, Ford Motor Finance finances the automobiles that the Ford Motor Company manufactures with Ford Motor Company glass and Ford Motor Company iron ore transported in Ford Motor Company iron ore carriers, and they put Ford Motor Company tires on their cars and so on down the line. Now, what is the common law opposite to that? It's called polygamous families. Polygamy. It makes all the sense in the world for Solomon to marry a princess who is an heiress, or who has a big dowry, or who is from a country that's on the border of Israel. In the same way, it would make a lot of sense for my daughter to marry the Wallace boy over here on our west border, because Jimmy Wallace owns a lot of farms. Jimmy Wallace owns the concrete company. He's a man of substance and stature here in the county. And it would just make all the sense in the world for my neighbor to marry my daughter. It would be good business for him, and it would be good business for the Gordons, and it would cement relations on our western frontier. And that's what Solomon was doing. In fact, that's what Queen Victoria was doing during her reign. She was marrying off the Windsor girls and boys and daughters and sons and cousins to the royalty of the other family tribes, to the Germans and the French and the Belgians and Norwegians and the Swedes and the Danes, because it cements relations between these kingdoms. Vertical integration. Now, that runs directly opposite to the state's interests, which is in corporations. You see, polygamy competes with corporations, and government hates competition. So by the 1870s, the United States government, looking at the wealth being generated by the Mormons, and looking at the wealth being generated by Mormon polygamy in vertically integrated families, looked upon polygamy as being a competition to United States Steel and to the railroad holdings. And they said, my God, if these Mormons are left to themselves, they'll take over the whole country. Well, Pharaoh had the same problem. He said, if these Israelites continue to multiply the way they're multiplying, they'll take over Egypt, which is why he took the Israelites into captivity and started killing the firstborn male children, or all of the male children, not just the firstborn, but all the male children of the Israelites. Population control. And it has its roots in business. It doesn't have anything to do with morality. The United States government operated a whorehouse, boys and girls, in Nevada for 16 months. Don't sit there and say to me that morality comes out of the Congress of the United States, the people who take bribes, the people who use drugs, the people who are sodomites and who legalize abortion and sodomy. That's not morality. That's perversity. That's perversion. That's filth. That's depravity. The Congress and the government of the United States and the governments of the states are the promoters of filth and perversion, not righteousness and morality. Polygamy comes from God Almighty, the same source that we find righteousness, that we find law and order, where we find the Ten Commandments. All right, we're out of time. I got to leave it right there, so let me give you a reminder that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide 7 days a week around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening. And good night, friends.